Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is our first staff attorney guest. We have Michael Ritter, who's a staff attorney at the Fourth Court of Appeals in San Antonio. And I'll let Michael introduce himself a little bit more. But Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit more kind of about your background, how you got to where you are, and kind of what you're doing now.
Sure. So I guess I'll start at the beginning. I was born in Austin, raised in Round Rock. I moved to San Antonio for college. I went to Trinity University, and then I went straight through to law school. I did my first year out in California. I had no previous ties or connections to California. It's just something that I did. And I think academic success sometimes often depends on being in the right place at the right time, having the right opportunities. But even though I was kind of a mediocre student up until law school, my first year, I was number two in my class by, I don't know how that happened. It just occurred.
Wow.
And so I had the opportunity to consider transferring, which I ultimately did to the University of Texas back home to Austin. When I was in school, money was kind of tight. I was working a couple part-time jobs throughout college and law school. And I remember there was one time where I went to go get my hair cut, and the hairstylist did a great job, and she used this product on my hair. And I walked out with this $12 bottle of hair gel that I thought made my hair look really good. But driving home and realized I needed that $12 to eat the next 2 days. And so I turned around and returned it. And kind of experiences like that, where when I was at UT, I kind of got attracted to the on-campus interviewing process with big law firms. But at that time, kind of like our current times, we're in an economic recession and the practice of law was being affected. And so at that time, I decided I needed to get involved in as much stuff in law school to beef up my resume as possible. And I started off with mock trial and thought, hey, it'd be great to be part of a mock trial competition team. And in order to compete at UT Law on a mock trial team, you had to go through this general session for training, and then they would break you out into smaller groups for practicing. And I was broken out into a smaller group, and we were practicing impeachment of a witness with a prior inconsistent statement. And when I was going through the process, the other student I was working with was the witness, and I said, would you please read the statement out loud? He said, no, I can't. And I was like, okay, well, why not? He says, I can't read. He said, well, that's interesting. And I just got really frustrated because I felt like that probably wasn't the place for me. And so I walked out of that training session thinking, there's no way I want to do trial work. Not a single possible way. And it was either that day or a couple days later that I saw a sign that said moot court tryouts, an arrow pointing in the direction where they were. And so I went to an information session about moot court, not realizing there was a difference between mock trial and moot court at the time. And I thought, hey, this involves a lot of researching, writing, and arguing about the law rather than, development of the facts of a case through evidence, that this seems a lot more up my alley. And so it was really through that process that I realized I wanted to do appellate work. And that also affected the decisions that I made about what coursework I wanted to take. And at UT, there's a lot of flexibility, not a lot of required courses. So I ended up taking about 7 or 8 different writing seminars, where instead of taking an exam at the end of the course, you would just submit a paper that you've been working on. And it was also a way for me to make some extra money on the side because I submitted to writing competitions. And ultimately, when I left law school, I had 7 student notes published in law journals.
Wow.
And I didn't have family law. I didn't have federal courts. What I did have was a lot of experience researching and writing these long articles about specific legal issues. And although it was a tougher sell to for a federal court clerkship, it was something that a lot of, I think, state judges were interested in. And that's kind of how I took the approach from law school going into the practice of law, with this idea that I wanted to do appellate law in some form or fashion.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. first-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
So where did you go after you graduated from UT Law?
My first year, I was a law clerk, we call them briefing attorneys in state court here in Texas, at the Fourth Court of Appeals for Justice Rebecca Simmons. And I was there for a little over a year. And then I had a second clerkship with Judge Mike Kiesler on the Court of Criminal Appeals. And so at that time, I had the experience in law school of interning at the Supreme Court. So I worked at the Supreme Court, Court of Criminal Appeals, and the Court of Appeals level before I went to the practice of law, ironically, as a trial lawyer at the Attorney General's office.
I've heard it said
that practicing trial work for some time can make you a better appellate lawyer. Certainly gives you some perspective. So I'd be curious to know, I know you weren't really setting out to be a trial lawyer, but did you find that experience valuable and adding to what you bring to the table today in your current position?
I think there was a lot of similarities in what I was doing at the Attorney General's office and the practice of appellate law, even though I've only, quote unquote, practiced from the appellate court side. And after doing my clerkships and going to work in the AG's office, it's always been government work. I've never worked a day in my life at a private law firm. But I knew going to work at the AG's office as a trial lawyer, I wanted to go back to the court to work as a permanent staff attorney. That was my goal. But in my head, I had this limiting belief that I needed to have several trials under my belt before anyone would take my application for a staff attorney position seriously. And so when I was at the AG's office, I was doing primarily civil defense work. It was an interesting transition from the Court of Criminal Appeals to civil litigation, but I ended up in a division that did civil litigation defense for criminal law enforcement agencies, which was a really neat intersection.
Yeah, it's an interesting hybrid.
Yeah, in criminal law, which took me back to my year at the Court of Appeals where transitioning between civil and criminal. And so it has kind of both components, which really attracted me to the position to begin with. But in that process, I had done all this researching and writing. My writing looked good. I was still a young lawyer, so I still had a lot to learn. But I was successful at getting, my cases dismissed on the pleadings or summary judgment. And really none of my cases went to trial. And then the one that finally did, I ended up going to a different division at the time. And so I didn't ever go to trials as a first jury, although I did two federal jury trials as a second chair. And so it was really more the researching and writing that I felt was the transferable skill to the Court of Appeals. And I think that one thing that I definitely learned was a briefing attorney at the Court of Appeals and at the Court of Criminal Appeals, you'd read these records and the issue finally gets selected for presentation at the appellate level, you're reviewing it and the appellee comes back and said, hey, this was not preserved. And, as a briefing attorney, you go back and look at it and it's like, hey, they didn't object to this. There's no objection here. How could this trial lawyer not have objected to this? And so when you had that trial experience, you realize that hindsight's 20/20 and you have a million things going on. And so I think the most valuable lesson that I took from being a trial lawyer to now working as a staff attorney at the Court of Appeals was that to be more gracious and understanding of the sort of the pressure that is put on you at trial.
Absolutely.
And the pressure even applies in researching and writing motions because you may have the time to sit down and write it, but you got to turn right around and work on another motion, another case, deposing another witness, and it's very fast paced. And it's good to have that perspective.
That definitely is, and it's one of those things where I think as an appellate lawyer, you do have to remember not to Monday morning quarterback the trial team because there's so many trade-offs that happen, and sometimes it's a strategic decision because you don't want to anger the judge or anger the jury, and it's easy to look back at that on a cold record and say, God, why didn't they do that when you're not in the heat of the moment with the judge staring down at you, glaring daggers because you're about to object to something that they're tired of hearing about.
Yeah, but I also noticed that there's stuff like that in legal researching and writing, whether it's motion practice in the trial court and appellate briefing, where you're assigned to work on this brief, or you have this brief you have to write, and you have the issues, do the research, and then you think about it, you file it, maybe you get set for oral argument, or the opinion comes out later, and you're like, why didn't I think of that clear and obvious argument I should have made? Even though you have, you know, significantly more time in that writing process, you know, you still get focused on making these professional judgments, and then you can sometimes Monday morning quarterback yourself. And I would encourage your listeners to, you know, always be, you know, kind to themselves and that, and, you know, we even make that mistake. Court of appeal is plenty enough too. So happens to everybody at every level, and you just got to move on and not second guess yourself so much.
Well, and it seems like, I mean, this is just sort of my take on it, but it seems like the Texas Supreme Court in the last few years have kind of relaxed some of the preservation rules a little bit, or at least have been more forgiving in trying to decide cases on the merits rather than kind of technical barriers, procedural barriers. And so I wonder if that's reflective of some of those justices kind of having the same feelings from their own experiences.
We could all use a little grace, definitely. Absolutely. I mean, if you're, you know, you're down in the heat of battle, especially in the trial courts, I'll tell you, it's one thing to stand at the lectern making an appellate argument and be stumped by a question from a trial judge. Usually, you know, you're prepared, you've read the record, you know the law. But people forget that when you're in the trial court, man, you are making this stuff out of whole cloth. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not applying the standard of review and filtering everything through that. So, you know, I'm around trial courts enough. I think Jody is too. It is, I respect the trial lawyers immensely, because that is a skill set that it just, you have to have a lot of plates. You have to have the capability of juggling a lot of plates at one time. And no, it is not easy. And it's certainly, you know, second guessing after the fact is a very easy thing to do. And so we all should be reminded that, look, there's a lot of other factors that come into this.
Absolutely. I know you were in the trial attorney job for a while. When did you go back to the court as a staff attorney? Like, how long have you been back there?
I returned to the Fourth Court of Appeals in November of 2014. So about 5.5 years that I've been back at the court.
I know before we started today, we kind of talked about the fact that I think a lot of people, even experienced appellate practitioners, don't necessarily know what role the staff attorney has. And of course, it's different at every court and with every chambers. But I mean, kind of generally, what are some of the things on your court that the staff attorneys are responsible for?
So our court has a hybrid system of central staff and chamber staff attorneys. We actually only have one central staff attorney, who's the mandamus attorney. She handles all the original proceedings that are filed. And the other 14 staff attorneys, there's two to each judge's chambers for the 7 judges of our court. And our role is primarily to advise the judges on how to rule in the appeals, on motions, and original proceedings when they're referred in chambers, and to help each other out on what we refer to in our court as monitoring issues. So for appellate practitioners, the monitoring issues that I'm referring to are everything that happens from the filing of a notice of appeal up until that last brief is filed that doesn't require a decision on the merits. So that's going to be any jurisdictional issues with the notice of appeal, motions to dismiss, motions for extension of time to file a brief. We're also dealing with the reporter, court reporter, and the trial court clerk, making sure everything's filed. And then most of our time is spent researching and writing for our judicial opinions. Our court recently hired a new clerk of the court, Mike Cruz. He's actually Justice Eva Guzman's former executive assistant. And he and I kind of developed a joke even before all this craziness, coronavirus and the ransomware attack, that our roles sometimes take us to unexpected places. And we noted that they're on these state job application forms. There's a job description, which is usually bullet points. And at the very bottom, there's a catch-all that says other tasks as assigned. And so we ended up doing a lot of things that we never thought we'd be doing. We're like, oh, other tasks as assigned.
I bet especially these days, you're kind of handling the remote work and you've had the ransomware come up. I bet you've found a lot of new roles you didn't know you were going to have.
Yeah, sometimes I think I play therapist to a lot of other staff attorneys. You know, that's more of a self-assigned thing. And it's what's been great about all this, it's been incredibly stressful for everybody. And it's been a test of our relationships with each other, judges to judge, judge to staff, and staff to staff. And one thing that we've done incredibly well is really pull through all of this together. And that's really just a matter of respecting each other professionally and personally.
Am I correct? Your judge actually had the coronavirus, right?
That's correct. She did. A couple of months ago, she learned that she had contracted it on travel. She was on spring break, and it was a travel-related case. And at that time, there were 11 people who were quarantined at military base here. And after there were first people in our community that had it, there were just like maybe about 9 or 10 cases. And I think she was one of those 9 or 10 cases who got it travel-related. So it was very early on in the process. And she's been very vocal about, you know, having it. She did an interview with the Express News, and her and her family were, you know, brave and courageous to come out with their story.
Absolutely.
And encourage other people to take this seriously. And, you know, how to handle it sort of going forward is really a matter of public policy for powers that be to really decide and to make those tough calls. But when it comes to the personal health, there are things that we can all do. And she was a really big advocate for making sure that we all do what we can to protect ourselves.
When Justice Chapa came out as having coronavirus, I mean, I saw her on Facebook and kind of watched that journey, and I admired how she was so vocal about it. I mean, it definitely brought it home that this happens to people you know, and you know, people you work with. And you know, since then, we've had some other judges in our system who have announced that they've acquired the virus. And but it's I certainly admire how she handled that in a way that's a good example to all of us, really, and taking it so seriously.
How's she doing, by the way?
She's doing a lot better. She's out of quarantine.
Good.
She's been working really hard on her cases, getting caught up. And she was doing a little bit, you know, here and there while she was in quarantine and still recovering. And everyone was saying, like, please take care of yourself first. This can all wait.
Absolutely.
But yeah, she's back at it. And we're continuing to keep on writing opinions and get them out the door.
I'm sure she's feeling the value of having a good staff.
Yeah.
Keeping the docket moving.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, she's very grateful and expresses her gratitude frequently, which is one of the reasons why I'm privileged to work with her. Sometimes supervisors don't always say, hey, good job, or thank you. And she's very gracious.
That's great. Well, you know, one of the things that we wanted to talk about with you, I know you've written a lot of articles. You did a lot in the law school, but you've written a lot since. And one of the ones that I think is either about to be published or was recently published was about en banc review and kind of discretionary judicial decision making. That's going to be in the review of litigation. Is that right?
That's correct. One of my interests in researching and writing my own articles and publications for Prevention of the Bar have centered around things that have caused me the most conflict with. And those issues usually center on something where the appellate court has discretion. They just don't know how to clearly and consistently and quickly make those discretionary decisions. Because as I said before, a lot of what we do is researching and writing for opinions where we don't have discretion to determine like what the law is, how it applies to the case. It's the law is the law, we apply it to the case. Now there may be gray areas where professional judgment comes in, but the judges approach that with my judgment is this law means this, and here's how it applies. It's not a decision that's like, I have discretion to choose either way. I'm going to choose this way. When it comes to discretionary decisions at the Court of Appeals, you know, some things are pretty straightforward. Whether to grant a motion for extension of time to file a brief. A lot of judges are like, sure, I have discretion to deny this, but why would I do that? So the more challenging discretionary decisions come into these proceedings and appeals where the decision about whether to either review the case initially, review it after it's been decided by a panel, are at play. And it's a little bit different from the Supreme Court, Court of Criminal Appeals, in the vast majority of their cases. You know, Criminal Appeals has mandatory jurisdiction over death penalty cases, but for civil practitioners, there's that initial gateway step of discretionary review. That's something that the judges on the Supreme Court of Texas are very comfortable with. It's part of the institution. But the Court of Appeals, the vast majority of what we get, we have to decide. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of a commitment to that cause to make sure that we do justice in every case that we can. And so whenever there's a discretionary appeal or a request for us to take a discretionary review of something, it's, well, how do we make that decision? Because we're unfamiliar with a lot of the times the precise standards that can apply to those. and what all should be factored into those decisions. And so the article that is coming out in the next couple months is called En Banc Review in Texas Courts of Appeals. As you know, Jody, that will be published in the Review of Litigation. And I intended that to be a comprehensive analysis of discretionary review by the en banc court of the panel's decision. There's interestingly not a lot of case law on what the en banc standards in Rule 41.2c, those are the extraordinary circumstances and maintain or secure uniformity of the court's decision standards. There's really no case law describing what those standards mean and how they apply in any given case. And what I noticed with en banc review, kind of like other discretionary appellate review procedures like permissive appeals, mandamus, is that in mandamus, the prudential in 2004, the Supreme Court kind of took like a law and economics approach to when mandamus review is appropriate and what constitutes an adequate remedy by appeal. You have to balance the jurisprudential considerations against the detriments, benefits against the detriments, to decide whether an appeal is adequate or not. And then in Sabre Tribal International for permissive appeals, the Supreme Court affirmed that it's entirely discretionary by the courts of appeals. But the underlying purpose behind it is this law and economics approach to judicial efficiency. And I took those approaches from those two proceeding or types of proceedings and try to place en banc review into the bucket of discretionary review procedures. And a lot of judges, they take a look at Rule 42.1c and think there's no discretion to grant en banc review unless one of these two standards are met. And this can affect resolutions of motions for en banc reconsideration. If, for example, the motion argues the panel erred, or whatever, but don't address the two standards. Sometimes the recommendations from the staff attorney is, hey, they don't address either two standards, we're done here. And sometimes the recommendation from the staff attorney is like, I think we really need to take a second look at it. And so there's been a lot of new appellate judges take the bench in the past couple of years. I know in our court that's kind of reinvigorated the conversation about what do these en banc standards mean. And so my article addresses trying to approach en banc review as a discretionary review procedure where we should also apply a law and economics approach similar to the other discretionary review procedures of permissive appeals and mandamus proceedings. And in addition to making a recommendation to the bench, the article also make recommendations to the bar and to best practices for researching for, writing, and filing motions for en banc reconsideration that really put together and synthesize a lot of the recommendations that are made in CLE papers. A lot of credit goes out to Steve Hayes, Scott Rothenberg, that call from the Third Court of Appeals for a lot of the thinking and the work they've already done on that, which made that part easy to put together.
That's super interesting.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
When a case is over in the Court of Appeals, and one party or the other has had a bad outcome, I mean, it happens in every case, you know, clients want to know what's next. And so you have to make a decision at that time whether to proceed with some further practice in the Court of Appeals or to go ahead and move on to the Texas Supreme Court. If there's a case to be made for that, you know, to me, en banc kind of gets lost sometimes because you're arguing or you're looking at your panel opinion. And unless you really dig deep in the law beneath the panel opinion, you know, the grounds, what I've always thought to be grounds for en banc review, which you outlined earlier, you know, they're not always apparent unless you've got a conflicting panel opinion from another panel. And that's the most obvious example I can think of, in which case, you know, certainly I wouldn't hesitate to seek en banc review if I was on the bad end of a decision that didn't go with precedent from that same court. That seems to me to be the kind of the most obvious use of en banc review is to sort of harmonize the results coming out of that particular court. But I think it's, you know, having best practices and so forth relating to en banc practice, I think will be very useful, because a lot of even very seasoned appellate lawyers don't really do it right, I think, in terms of in my own, and I'm not saying that I do it right, but it's, you know, it's an issue that you've only got so many bites at the apple. And what I do tell clients sometimes is, hey, you know, if you've got a conceivable, defensible en banc issue, you know, that is a bite at the apple that you are probably going to want to take.
It is.
And having a roadmap to go about doing that, I think, will be super helpful.
Yeah, and the article definitely covers a lot of those topics. And it notes that en banc review motions and motions for rehearing generally are some of the most difficult, challenging legal writing assignments that a lawyer can have, because you're trying to convince a court that's already made a decision that they're wrong, instead of trying to convince another court that another court's wrong. And so it's very challenging to strike a proper tone and to really argue it in such a way that you're already running up against confirmation bias, the court. They've already spent a lot of work on it. They think they got it right. And then you also have to deal with, you know, potential, you know, defensiveness, you know, justified that, you know, of the work that's been put into it. And so some of the recommendations are about how to approach that in a very neutral way that doesn't come off as, you know, sometimes legal writing, you can get frustrated, and sometimes that frustration reads off the paper. And another recommendation that's made in the article is when you're considering filing a motion for en banc reconsideration, that the goal of the practitioner and the goals of the court aren't the same. And so you have to find where those goals overlap. This practitioner, you're trying to get better result for your client than you got from the panel. And from the court's perspective, en banc review is only going to be appropriate for, depending on the view of the court, for conflicts or inconsistencies and things that are truly extraordinary. And so some of the things that, one of the things that I recommend for en banc motions is to frame the motion around tapping into the values that underlie these two en banc standards, which is uniformity and extraordinary circumstances. And sometimes whenever you have your case and the panel errors, there's some conflict between judges like that think that en banc review is not proper to correct panel errors, where you have a significant historical argument in support of why it is appropriate to correct panel errors. But it's not so much of that proving the panel erred. It's about the effect of the panel's error, the parties in the case, other parties that are similarly situated, and upon the court itself if there is a conflict. And some courts require there to be a very clear, direct conflict with a prior decision of the court, whereas I think that the historical development of en banc review supports a broader interpretation of where there's inconsistencies that reflect on the court's integrity as an institution, which is actually language from one of the seminal U.S. Supreme Court cases on en banc review, that trying to tap into the values of consistency and justice for the parties in a particular case, rather than just the panel got it wrong.
Which is, I mean, that's interesting. You know, to Todd's point, that's one that you don't necessarily think about when you're reading a court opinion and, you know, kind of internalizing, well, is there a conflict with this? And instead of thinking about it from a more institutional perspective of, is there something here that we can point out to the court that, you know, maybe doesn't look right or could be, you know, a little bit more well-defined. That's kind of an interesting approach that I don't know that I've really thought through.
Also going to present challenges, because if you say that the court's conflicting with a prior decision, to really flesh out the value of your being inconsistent, you're going to run afoul of those other, you know, recommendations to be neutral. And so it really requires a refined sense of appellate judgment and legal research and writing skills to strike all the right chords. Mm-hmm. Even when you do that, it's entirely discretionary.
Of course. But, you know, well, it's always hard because you're asking them to sort of sit in judgment of their own colleagues rather than, you know, a trial court or the Supreme Court looking at what a lower court did. You're kind of saying, hey, the people down the hall got it wrong. You really need to substitute what you're thinking for what they say, which is never an easy conversation to have with a court.
It seems like there are, you know, some cases that might be more clear cut, like, you know, a panel opinion that just takes a 180 from a previous panel opinion, because you get into a situation like that and you're talking about, well, what are the expectations of the parties and being able to rely on precedent?
Yeah.
It's one thing to follow one line of precedent or the other if there's possibly two different lines between and among the 14 intermediate courts and, you know, who knows what the Supreme Court has said. But when, you know, seemingly parties, I think it's a sort of a universal principle that parties ought to be able to rely on the precedent of the court. And if the court accidentally, because it could only be accident, right? issues an opinion that's, you know, totally divergent from prior precedent, that's a fairly clear-cut use of en banc review, I would think. But I can appreciate what you're saying, Michael, about, you know, there needs to be, you need to exercise caution and judgment in how it's presented, because, you know, just telling the panel, hey, you got it wrong. Oh, and by the way, we're taking it up with the other judges too, before we take it upstairs to the Supreme Court. Yeah, there might be some inclination to kind of dig in on the position at that point.
Yeah. One of the challenges when you have a panel decision that is clearly wrong is to overcome this popular belief that, oh, the panel just got it wrong and we may disagree, but that's not the proper use of en banc review. Because there is, as you noted, you know, kind of being superior to the folks who office next to you and exercising that the role of the en banc court. But one of the things that's noted and discussed in the article is that panel review is actually kind of a weird government decision-making process, because most governmental entities require, you know, democratic society majority vote. In panel decision-making, you can have potentially two judges making majority of a panel over one dissenter decide the law for, in the case of the Dallas Court of Appeals, another 11 other judges on court. And so what other democratic institution makes decisions based on minority rule? And so it's often said that panel review is a general rule, but en banc review is an exception to that general rule. But my perspective on it is that panel review is an exception to the general democratic principle of majority rule. It's a minority rule system, so it's an exception. En banc review is merely an exception to the exception that allows the court sitting as a whole to exercise its primary function, which is to do justice in the case.
That is a very appellate lawyer answer when we're talking about exceptions to exceptions. But I do appreciate that, because that's a framing that, you know, I don't think I've ever thought about that way, but it makes a lot of sense that you only have potentially two members out of 12 or 13 that decide something for a whole court. And this may be totally anecdotally, but in the last year or so since we've had judicial transitions, I've seen several en banc rehearing motions, not in my cases, but just in cases I'm following, where they've kind of said, hey, new members on the court, maybe you should just reevaluate this prior panel decision that influenced the decision here, because that seems like that was wrongly decided. And that's an interesting approach. And I guess I can understand why you would come from that hope that maybe these new sets of eyes would see things differently.
That whole exception to the exception thing, just, I think my head exploded. I'm done for the day.
You know, the other one that you mentioned kind of briefly, and we don't have to go in depth, is permissive appeals. That's one of the things that I have seen a lot more of in the last couple of years, where I think you're, same idea, it's a little bit different, but you're trying to get the court to take on work that they don't have to take on when everything else they do is non-discretionary and so much of it is accelerated, and now you're trying to throw something else at them. But that's another interesting discretionary thing. And like you mentioned, the Sabre case, where the Supreme Court says, well, even if they don't look at it, we will, and we may decide it on the merits in the first instance. I think that whole area of practice is really kind of interesting to watch it develop too.
Yeah, along the same lines as the en banc review, sort of acknowledging the existence of another option for these parties to get justice in the Court of Appeals, like, oh, we could take it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court always has the authority to grant review. It was kind of like, oh, okay, well, we're not standing between you and justice, because they get to the Supreme Court and let them, you know, tackle these tough issues. But yeah, it's along the same lines. Like, you might have the standards met, but ultimately, as the Supreme Court noted in Sabre Travel, even a congested docket is sufficient reason to deny a permissive appeal. And so then it kind of goes back to the law and economics approach from the court's perspective. It's about trying to tap into the court's values that they're trying to protect and promote, while also cutting against the grain with the fact that it's another appeal for them to decide mm-hmm. is sort of less efficient for them. But what we're seeing more frequently, and I think in our court and others, is you'll see multiple appeals from the same case. It's like, oh, it's these people again, they're back. And what is it now? And so I think that the idea of subsequent appeals in a case is very concrete to judges. And if a permissive appeal could prevent parole appeals in the future by making an early decision about a controlling question of law, then I think that's your selling point, is that this is actually going to save you work down the line.
Right.
Yeah.
Hard sell, but you know, it's an option there.
No, it is. And it's, you know, there's that sort of law and economics, that pragmatic side of it that you talk about, that I think the courts seem to recognize. It's really costly to have somebody go through an entire trial proceeding, whatever that entails, only to come up with a question that we're then going to have to answer on appeal and then maybe have to force you to do a do-over, when at the outset we can jump over this and decide this legal question that doesn't require any factual resolution and hopefully get everybody a good answer and maybe get rid of the case back there, which I think is appealing for everyone, including the clients, if they can avoid that process and just the delay and money that has to be thrown into that.
Right.
It was interesting. Another article I wrote, I think it was for the Appellate Advocate, called Let It Go, as the Texas Supreme Court actually disposed of the final judgment rule as a general rule. And it's this idea that we came from this place of trying to jealously guard appellate court resources from, you know, excessive and multiple appeals in every single case. So the final judgment rule is a general rule, and we're just going to have a few exceptions for interlocutory appeals. And then over time, it's like, okay, more interlocutory appeals and also permissive appeals. And also we're going to expand mandamus availability. And which caused me to question, is the final judgment rule even the general rule anymore? It seems like it's just one of many ways to get your case in front of the Court of Appeals. And when I was writing that, I was having a conversation with somebody, I don't remember who it was, about maybe Texas should just get rid of the final judgment rule and sort of make determinations about whether to accept appeals based on, you know, more general law and economics approach. Whereas some things like incident, like truly incidental, like small minuscule matters aren't going to be reviewed, and others that are significant can be reviewed to make that process more streamlined for the courts of appeals. I think the problem with that is, well, what are appellate practitioners supposed to know to be appealed or not? There would need to be some line drawing that necessarily need to occur in those circumstances. So. But in the Dallas Symphony case, the Supreme Court decided last year, Judge Heck said pretty much echoed those same sentiments, which was that we have all these exceptions to the final judgment rule. Really, the final judgment rule can't even be called the general rule.
Mm-hmm. Well, and every session, the legislature seems to add another category to 51.014 that, you know, gives you a little bit more workload and an accelerated appeal.
Yeah, that was my kind of come to Jesus moment in writing that Let It Go article. It was kind of a Justice Wainwright's inspiration in the A Lad in a Whole New World. I started the article with Let It Go from Frozen, mm-hmm. not only to mean like, let's let the final judgment rule as a general rule go, but also personally let go of all the frustrations of all these interlocutory appeals and the proceedings, because literally nothing's going to stop. It's going to keep coming. And on the bright side, it keeps us busy at the Court of Appeals and job security. So, and it's good for the parties to be able to have that option to prevent, you know, wasteful trial court proceedings when there's been an error.
Well, I know we're kind of getting towards the end, but just briefly, you guys have had a lot of challenges the last few months, like everybody else, and you've been working remotely in your court, and I think a lot of the other courts have too. And then on top of that, you had ransomware, but you know, it seems like technology has really enabled the court to respond pretty nimbly and continue its operations during these times. What kind of stuff do the courts have in place that have allowed you to keep the doors open, so to speak, virtually?
I think a lot of the, I listened to some of the other episodes, and I think David Slayton and Blake Hawthorne covered a lot of sort of technological opportunities and devices that are being used by the courts of appeals and the appellate courts generally. I think that maybe to answer your question in a way that's more specific to courts of appeals and our court, the fourth court, is in response to the ransomware attack, because the first line of technology is down. What's the backup? And we've been fortunate at the fourth court, and people don't know this, but OCA kind of operates as information resource for the appellate courts, and they also provide IT support to a lot of courts. Some of the larger courts also have on-site IT person, and the Fourth Court was lucky to have an on-site IT guy, Del Merritt, and he's been very rigorous over the years of keeping backups of backups of backups. And fortunately, some of our backups weren't affected by the ransomware attack. And in addition to that, we also, some courts use the TAME system, Texas Appeals Management e-filing system. So whenever a document's e-filed through the e-filing service, it then gets portaled into the TAME system where we can review it. It's timestamped, and then it gets distributed to the proper judges' chambers. And so the courts that were heavily reliant on TAMEs for voting and uploading opinions and circulating opinions have been challenged, particularly by the ransomware attack. Our court uses TAME for a lot, but a lot of the motions and opinions we circulate via email. And sometimes we do jurisdiction checks by having the clerk's record emailed to us. And so for a lot of our cases, we were able to just pull from our emails the clerk's record, the reporter's record, the briefs, you know, prior draft and opinion. That's been allowing us to continue to issue, I think we've issued 39 opinions since the ransomware attack occurred. And that's what allows us to stay online.
I'm looking at txcourts.net, which is the secondary site that was created as a result of the ransomware attack for the posting of courts' opinions. And I think the Fourth Court of Appeals is by far the most active court in terms of posting links on that site. So that is interesting. So can we assume that some of these courts that haven't had orders posted, that perhaps they're more reliant on the TAME system than the Fourth Court is?
I think so. It's hard to know. You know, we have the annual meetings of the Texas Association of Appellate Court Attorneys where we talk about different practices, but I'm not sure this has ever come up before. I'm sure it will be a topic this year. I'll have an answer for you in a few months. And I do know that the Dallas Court kind of did their own thing for a long time. They had their own website, their own server and everything. And so I think they were much less affected by
Courtstuff.net is back online, I noticed, during all this.
Right. A blast from the past.
Yeah, absolutely. What's happening on other courts. It does look like the 13th Court of Appeals has been active, and I don't know why the Court of Criminal Appeals hasn't issued any.
And have y'all been doing Zoom oral arguments in your court, right?
That's correct. I believe 3 oral arguments done, and they were a couple of weeks ago or last week. The time's all been running together.
I understand that.
A couple months. And they went off really well. Even with the ransomware attack, I think we have the entire record for 2 cases and almost the entire record for another case missing just 1 volume of the reporter's record. So the judge were able to have, you know, in the era of coronavirus and ransomware attack, a 3 oral arguments that might have not occurred otherwise.
Well, that's impressive. What can you tell us, Michael, about the en banc order extending time to file briefs? I mean, we've seen, I think about half of the 14 courts have issued these sort of blanket orders, and we don't have to get into the details of the order other than to say that, you know, without even the need to file a motion, the court has made the decision. The briefing deadlines that are currently underway, where the clock is ticking, are automatically extended to June 30th with certain exceptions. The exceptions being primarily mandamus proceedings or original proceedings in certain family law cases. So can you tell us anything about the court's purpose in issuing that order? Would it have happened apart from ransomware, or was it really driven by ransomware?
I can't speak to the decision of my court to make that decision, unfortunately. I'm not sure I can provide any more insight from, you know, taking off my Court of Appeals staff attorney hat. My guess would be that it was in response to the ransomware attack rather than coronavirus. I am not sure if this type of order would have been so popular if one court did issue it without the ransomware attack, if other courts would have followed. I think that might have been made not at all, or maybe only by 1 or 2 courts.
I think the real question in my mind on this is I sort of expected this to be fairly uniform, that we would see, you know, orders out of virtually all, if not all, of the courts, if not a blanket order out of the Texas Supreme Court. But it seems like the Supreme Court has taken a real hands-off approach. We've got a new emergency order that's come out 2 days ago that starts to map out the future of jury trials in our state, but it says nothing about briefing deadlines. And this was after, you know, a number of the courts started issuing these blanket orders. And so it seems like the Supreme Court is letting each of the intermediate courts do its own thing on extending these deadlines. And so you may not be able to comment on that, and I certainly appreciate that. That's just been an observation on my end. Is I'm telling my trial lawyer clients and folks that I work with, you know, don't assume anything. You better look and actually lay your hands or lay your eyes on an order out of your court that says what you think maybe it should say, because, you know, there's even a little bit of variation between and among the orders themselves.
If I can provide any more insight to that, I think it might be because there are so many cases in the courts of appeals that are different stages. And without a blanket order, I think a lot of the judges, especially now, are, you know, I think even before coronavirus, they were inclined to grant them liberally up to, you know, two or three motions before requiring something more specific. And so I think that there's still that default feeling among the courts of appeals justices to sort of grant these, even more so when you add on coronavirus, and even more so when you add on there's a ransomware attack. And so I think that perhaps it's kind of a lower priority for the Supreme Court because, you know, there's still that default system of liberal granting, especially in these times. And there also may be some cases where, you know, that it's on the fifth or sixth extension, and the court has been very clear that if you don't file, it's going to be dismissed. If a blanket order came by, they're like, ah, got another 30 days. We'll start this process over again.
Yep.
You know, a month or so.
Sounds like some people I know. But,
maybe you're getting close to figuring out who's responsible for the ransomware after all. No more extensions absent good cause, click.
Yep. Create good cause for the whole state. All right.
I'm perfectly fine with, you know, folks having more time given the everything that's happening. And I think that's something shared by who I work with, although I can't speak for them. And so I think this is a reflection of just extending that court by court, making those determinations that even if we're in that fifth or sixth extension, you know, are bad, right? We don't have what we...
Everybody needs a little grace these days.
Going back to
your earlier point.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we've definitely gone past the usual time that we spend with each guest, but what you've had to say has been very interesting. And I think our listeners will find it that way too.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for spending the time with us. You know, it's our tradition to ask each guest to share a tip or a war story relevant to appellate practice. And I'm sure in your position, you know, you probably have a few. We like hearing when the justices tell us the do's and don'ts of practicing in their court. That's always very useful. So what along those lines, Michael, might you offer up?
I was thinking something a little bit broader. I think I could write a book on best practices in the Court of Appeals. Maybe forthcoming. I don't know. We'll see. But if I'm allowed to offer something a little bit more general than a specific tip,
sure.
Then our recommendation to the listeners would be to get involved in your local and state appellate sections if you can. For the opportunity to meet us, your staff attorneys, throughout the state, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what we do, how decisions are made, and it's really about getting to know us. And it's not, some people are staff attorneys because they don't want to be that involved, but a lot of us are. The Fourth Court of Appeals, the chair of our appellate section in San Antonio is Matt Compton, staff attorney. Our new incoming chair is Haley Ellison, also a staff attorney at the Court of Appeals. One of our recent, a staff attorney who recently left, she was the president of the Bexar County Women's Bar. We're out and about, get to know us. And I think we'll add value to your appellate practice because it's not going to make a difference in the merits of your case. But what it does is for those discretionary things, whether it's a permissive appeal, en banc review, or even a motion for extension of time, to know you, individualize you and your character, allows us to dispel any doubts about whether or not you're yanking your chain, whether you're going to be able to present a case, your tone, so it doesn't come across in a particular way because, you know, we've had conversations with you. And so it's those subtle things that really add value to your practice. I mean, it's not going to make a difference in your case, but it's going to give us more confidence in you. So opportunity to get involved, please do.
That's a great tip and one that I'll echo as someone who's involved in our local bar section. It is just a great way to meet the people at the court and get to know them and get to understand on a deeper level how it all works.
Yeah,
I completely agree.
Before a couple of years ago, I wasn't involved in everything. I've become kind of a bit of a bar junkie. I'll make this real quick before we wrap it up. And so I took a very justice's blind approach to writing opinions, like, okay, I got a brief, whatever, all right, here's the opinion. And a lot of times I get asked by the judges, oh, who's the lawyer on that case, or who's the trial judge in that case? And I was like, I don't know. I don't even look, because I don't know who the people are anyway. And it shouldn't matter, so why are you asking me? And after getting more involved and getting into the trial judges and the lawyers, what it's helped me is I can now like visualize, like make it more concrete for me. And sometimes we get this compassion fatigue in our jobs and seeing, you know, bad stuff over and over again happen and sort of try not to internalize that, kind of just turn ourselves into machines and just publish an opinion and get it out the door. But what that does is helps us to humanize what we do at the Court of Appeals, because it is remote, even when we're not working remotely.
Right. Those are great points and good advice. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, we want to thank our listeners.
Before we go, we'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters, the folks who bring you Westlaw and other great research tools, and Court Surety Bond Agency, the place to go if you need a supersedious bond.
We appreciate you listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
And taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everybody who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope that you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.